this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for being with us for another episode of Y'allitics. Jason Wheeler here with you this time. Whiteley not with us this time around. He was actually one of the many, many people who were stranded in places overseas because of that big mess up that happened in London when Heathrow Airport shut down. So he's been trying to make his way back to the U.S., and so we are going it alone this week. But a really special episode here for you, because just the other day, we got to go out to Arlington, Texas, right there between Dallas and Fort Worth, to the new National Medal of Honor Museum. This is the medal that is given. It is the highest award given for valor in this country. It is presented by the president to a recipient in the name of Congress. We went there to talk to the guy who is in charge of this new museum, who, by the way, has been on the podcast with us before in a whole different capacity. And while we were there, it happens that there was a Medal of Honor recipient in the building, which is an absolute blow you away kind of thing, because think about this. There are only 61 living recipients of the Medal of Honor. And so they asked, would you like to talk to him too? And we said, yes, absolutely. We would be amazed and honored to be able to sit down with him even for just a few minutes. And so not only did we do that, we are going to start this podcast off with him. Just an incredible story. He is retired Army Staff Sergeant Clint Romachet. Sergeant Romachet, thank you so much for dropping in and being here with us. I did not expect this. This was a bonus as we are putting this podcast together here. Where are you from?
So originally I was born and raised in Northern California. I get to brag. I graduated in the top 15 of the 14 kids I went to high school with. I grew up in a town of 100 people, went to school in a town of 500.
Wow.
Grew up...
Your class was really... small.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Like I said, I can always brag. I was a product of C's get degrees. So me and school weren't the best. But grow up, we raised alfalfa and dairy cows. Agricultural background. So come my senior year and my parents got me luggage for my graduation present, I realized I should probably get out and do something with my life. Back in 99, there wasn't a whole lot going on. So I joined the Army because I was tired of digging fence posts and milking cows. I wanted to see the world and maybe get some college money.
And you had that luggage.
And so I had that luggage already ready to go, but then the Army gave me different stuff. So
seems like it worked out okay, though. And you know, before we get into your service, I think it's important because, you know, that's sort of the bent that we were talking about just a few moments ago, is that this place can inspire you to do a lot of things, not just military things. But part of the inspiration there, I think, is that you said, you know, there are young people out there who might hear that and go, well, you know, I don't do the greatest in school or whatever. You can still rise to the top of whatever you do.
No, there's not one perfect path to figure out life. Like I said, if there's one thing I know is nothing's ever going to stay the same, and things are always going to change. Mm-hmm. And I look back to my time. I look at it as the Book of Clint. I can go back and read all those chapters. I can't take the white out and change them. Mm-hmm. So I can't live in those past chapters. I can write the future ones, though. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're looking forward to what tomorrow brings, you can always look back at your past and realize how you got there, but we gotta be focused on tomorrow.
The next chapter. Clint, I've given up looking for that white out too. you do spend some time in life, though, like, gosh, if I could just erase some of this. I wanna talk about your service here, because you served from 1999 to 2011. And if you could just familiarize the audience listening and watching with what it was that brought you here to this day with that extraordinary medal around your neck.
You know, that's what really blows me away. Like I said, joining in 99, my dad was a Vietnam veteran. So when I went up to him to tell him I was going to enlist, you know, he gave me that simple advice of, hey, maybe not today, maybe not in 20 years, but if you put that uniform on, you might have to go and do and see things that no one should have to go do and see. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea what I was 18 years old. I thought I knew everything. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until my first deployment to Kosovo in 2000 that really put in perspective what Dad was talking about. And like I said, I was gonna be one of those guys. I'd do 4 years, get that college money, figure out where to grow up and do the next chapter in life. And then of course we had September 11th happen. And you know, you join a lot of guys join for one reason, but you end up serving for another.
And that was yours?
And that was what motivated me, just being around those brothers and stuff. I ended up, by the time I got done with my 12 years, I'd done two deployments to Iraq, and then finally 09 Afghanistan I'd received for actions in October 3rd of 2009. That's when I received the medal.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We were, like I said, we were at this place called Combat Outpost Keating. It was one of those situations where it wasn't the most ideal. Whoever picked the location, it's just one of those things where we sat all the way at the bottom of a valley, surrounded by mountains on all four sides.
That's not a good position to be in.
Well, I love riding homes. I'm gonna tell on myself. So by then my granddad had passed away, my grandmother was still alive, and I love grandma to death, but I wrote her a letter home when I first got there, and it's like, grandma, hey, we're all settled in, the guys' morales look high, we got 12 months here, we're gonna get through this, get back home. This reminds me of growing up in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Mm-hmm. I get to look up at these gorgeous mountains every day. A couple weeks later, grandma sent me a letter back, and the first line of that was, what the hell are you doing looking up?
Wow.
My grandma knew that you're supposed to take the high ground. But it was really inspiring, though. Even though we were down in that valley, surrounded by mountains on all four sides, we'd get attacked generally once a day. But it was the younger enlisted guys, Mace and Jones. Like everybody knew it wasn't the greatest. But they had that tenacity of, we can't change this. So why are we gonna sit here and dwell on something we can't affect? Let's just be together for each other and get through this.
And you say younger, how old were they, roughly?
Shoot, Copus would have been 19 at the time. Mace was just about to be 20. I mean, you know, and in the military, when you're 28, you're the old man.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was really inspiring to see those. I mean, that was their first kind of combat deployments. Like I said, that was my third one. Been 10 years in, I was the old salty NCO. And those guys inspired me that we just had to get through that place. And I said, on October 3rd, 2009, six o'clock in the morning, Taliban hit us with about 400 fighters. Hmm. Breached our perimeter, overran our defenses within the first hour they were inside the wire. Things went just from bad to worse that day. Right away, we'd lost. We lost Kevin Thompson up at the mortar pit. They suppressed that whole area. We ended up losing eight guys that day. But just with everybody relying on each other, we were able to push back. We were able to find all eight of those heroes, made sure we brought them back, pushed the enemy back outside the wire, closed them off. And after about 12 hours, the dust finally settled. And then we flip around and we still got nine more months left in combat. Jeez. After that day.
In the same place?
We relocated a little farther south after that. We were already on the exit because the Army realized that location wasn't ideal. So we were actually just about a week away from closing that outpost down before the enemy hit us.
What did you do that day that brought you to having this around your neck?
Well, I did my job, and I felt like I did my job like any other red-blooded American. You could have plucked me out and put someone else in there. You know, they give me credit for going out and leading a counterattack, calling in close air support, going to find, like I said, we were isolated from about nine of those guys, a large majority that day. And that was, like I said, my biggest worry was knowing the Taliban, one of their big things is they could get the body of an American soldier. That was a huge propaganda thing for them. And even though, you know, you tell the guys, we're all going over, but we're all not coming back alive, you're still bringing everybody back. So that was a big motivation. Once we kind of got the momentum back on our side with that counterattack, we were able to go out and get Griffin and get Scusa and get Gallegos and bring those men back so we could make sure they came back home.
Hmm. When you describe what you did, you say they give me credit for, but you did it. You did do these things. You're very humble about it, and I would imagine that's probably true of a lot of the recipients.
Well, it's one of the, if it wasn't for those guys, I wouldn't be here. So if I can talk about them and shine that light on them, that's truly the most amazing thing. I mean, I look back now, you know, Jonesy, he's got a family, he's got three kids now. Copus is a guidance counselor in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm. Raz is down here in Texas, he does roofing now. It's so great to see what those men have done after service and continuing forward. Hmm. Brad Larson went to go fly Chinooks, just retired last year. And it's just great to see how you can go through something like that, but it's, like I said, it's on the backside of still sticking together and being with each other and knowing that tomorrow is going to be better as long as we show up for it. And if it wasn't for those great men, I wouldn't be here.
So you're here at the museum now. Do you live in Texas now?
No, I live in Minot, North Dakota. Went up, got out of the Army, chased oil fields, settled up that way in the Bakken oil fields. Because I was out of the Army for 2 years before I even got told I was put in for the medal. So I made that transition just like every other veteran, tried to figure out that last year of service. My plan A fell through, plan B fell through. I realized, hey, I gotta figure out how to support my family and continue on with life. And like I said, I'm a huge fan that we need more. You always need to continue your education, but it doesn't have to come from going to college. Go to the trades, learn how to be a plumber, HVAC, welding, like very well-paid jobs. And getting up to the oil field, I didn't think any of my service would kind of translate over. But that little bit of common sense, the attention to detail, being able to show up to work on time, like those are things that employers really, really looked at. And I got up there, started working, and in 6 months, I was managing 8 hydro excavator trucks. So I thought I'd just be the low man on the totem pole, being just the labor, you know, and very quickly they seen kind of those skill sets, those soft skills that the military gives you.
Turns out they translate pretty well.
You know, it's a weird thing. You just think, well, you know, everyone told me just what to wear and where to be, but it's that little bit of initiative, you know, understanding rules and regulations, having tact when you're talking to other people and how to figure out how to get the most potential out of them. It's stuff that employers love with our military service.
Let me ask you this. So you've seen your exhibit here. What'd you think about it? How did you handle that, reading it and seeing it?
It was, like I said, it's surreal to sit there, and they did such a phenomenal job. What really struck me, and I didn't realize it was going to be part of my display, is they had a photo there of the aircraft I was landing in Dover that was taking Stephen Mace's body off the plane. And like I said, it just kind of took me by surprise just thinking about that kid. So I had to take another picture of it and send it to his mom. And share that moment with her, knowing that even though Stephen Mace isn't here anymore, the museum's making sure he's not forgotten.
How much did that mean to you?
It meant a whole lot. Like, it's those little attention to details that they've done here that, you know, like I said, it just kind of took me by surprise when I seen it. The care and the, like I said, that attention to detail and the reverence of it. I hope that moves everybody that comes through these halls and sees all these exhibits, gets them to their core and lets them know freedom isn't free and it's that sacrifice. And if we don't have another generation to stand up and do it tomorrow, it's just one day away from being gone.
It's precious. You have to defend it.
Absolutely.
You've no doubt seen other exhibits here. What's your thought when you see some of these stories and you take these things in?
You know,
I mean, you're with them.
Most of the recipients, I don't even know what their story is, because when we get together, we're talking about what the kids are up to, what sports they're in, what you've been doing, kind of in your off time. It's very rarely. Actually, never do we sit down and kind of reminisce about the actions that day. So it wasn't until walking around here, reading some of the other guys' plaques, it's like, oh, okay, well, I remember hearing that, you know, when I was over in Iraq on the first one, hearing about Sal Junta and the ambush there, and hearing about Earl Plumlee. And I mean, it's great to see that, but it's also great to know these other recipients and put our pants on one leg at a time. Still gotta take out the trash when the garbage gets full. It's just amazing though. Never in a million years did I think I'd ever meet a Medal of Honor recipient. So let alone be one, it's still hard to wrap my head around sometimes. But also know it's a powerful thing to show the next generation what this country stands for. It's great to have the voice to speak for those veterans that no longer have it themselves, and to share all the stories of all those men and women that put on that uniform. I couldn't tell you how impressed I was for an entire generation. I said, I joined in 99. We didn't have anything going on. An entire generation, kids that were born on September 11th, were still raising that right hand at 18 years old. Mm-hmm. No one they were going to combat. We had an entire generation do that for over 20 years. That's something special.
Mm-hmm. Does it surprise you that we didn't have a Medal of Honor museum before now?
You know, it was kind of interesting to understand. Yeah, that's our nation's highest decoration for service in combat. But again, it's better late than never, and we got it accomplished now. And it took a while for these walls to come up, but now to look at it and see it, it was worth the wait. Worth the wait.
Because sometimes it takes some time to do it right.
It does.
My last question for you is, for the people who will come here, and the hopes, I guess, of what they will take away from this experience, and I guess there can be a lot of hopes of what they might take away, but this is a political podcast, and you know, we've talked a lot over the years about how much we are polarized and how much Americans are kind of at each other's throats right now, and it's, you know, my tribe versus your tribe. Is this a good antidote for that, to come in here and walk these halls?
I think what I hope people will take away when they see it, they'll see that it was just ordinary Americans from all walks of life, different backgrounds, different religions, social economy, all of those things. There's no cookie cutter G.I. Joe that you can sit there and say, this guy's gonna serve and receive the medal. It's everybody from New York to California to North Dakota to Texas. It's all different walks of life coming together to understand that our journey starts somewhere. You don't know where it's going to end up, but when you're faced with that challenge deep down inside, I hope they get the inspiration to know that they can stand up to do the right things for the right reasons at the right time. That is what I think makes us Americans.
And there was no Team Red and no Team Blue on October 3rd of 2009 with you down there.
It was not. No. It wasn't about the politics. It was literally about, that's the other weird thing is, I seen so much love that day. And you don't think of that in the chaos of combat. I said, duty will get a guy to, when you tell him to go move out and draw fire, he's gonna do that. But it's that love for your brother to your left and right that'll literally get them to run through a hail of bullets for you. It's a special thing.
Well, thank you for everything that you have done, and it is such an honor and pleasure to meet you and be able to get your story.
Very welcome. Thank you for letting me share it.
What a humble man, especially when you consider what he did. I'm told, though, that a lot of recipients who have been there to the museum, including in hours when the public wasn't in, are the same way. Just very humble, very soft-spoken about what they did. They always give credit to the people who didn't make it out of those situations with them. But make no mistake, with just Clint Romesha here, retired Army Staff Sergeant Clint Romesha, documentaries and movies have been made about his heroics. And that's the same for anyone who has gotten this award. I mean, these are just incredible stories of valor. And we have more about that now with the museum's CEO, Chris Cassidy, a retired U.S. Navy SEAL and NASA astronaut. Thanks so much for doing this and for having us into this extraordinary museum. You all really knocked it out of the park here.
Oh man, thank you. We've known as a staff and a board, we've known it's going to be a special thing for the nation, also for the DFW area, but really truly it's a national project. We've known it was going to be special. It's now fun for us and rewarding and to hear the feedback and to feel like, okay, we delivered. We think this is going to be really well received.
Because you had an opening over the weekend, and you're getting to see it now through other people's eyes. What are people telling you just in the early going here as far as feedback goes?
Well, there's a couple aspects of that answer. One is the architecture. It's really striking. And there's a lot of symbology there, right? Like the building essentially is a giant slab of steel supported by five columns, each column representing a branch of the service, and the symbology there is our nation's military allows us to enjoy the freedoms we have, and therefore is supporting us all, and that's the concept there with the museum itself is supported by those. And then once you get upstairs to the exhibit deck, the storytelling that happens up there, it's really unlike any museum I have ever been to. It's not written in a chronological way. It's not by conflict. It's not by, okay, these are all the Army hoax. These are all the Navy. It's because courage in 1861 is the same thing as courage today. So when we realized that several years ago in the design process, hey, let's sprinkle all the stories independent of time, service, conflict, let's just sprinkle them all around the whole footprint and let visitors experience it in their own path each time.
That's a great idea. Can you talk a little bit about why here? Not only in Texas, but where it ended up here. It's, you know, for people who aren't from DFW who are listening to the podcast, it's in Arlington, right next to where the Texas Rangers play, right next to the stadium where the Dallas Cowboys play. Why in Texas and why here?
So the concept of a Medal of Honor museum is not a new one. It's been kicked around in several cities or several instances throughout the several decades that I'm aware of. And this is coming from some of the older Medal of Honor recipients kind of conveying the stories. In about 2018 or 19, I forget the exact time, maybe 19, a request for proposals was put out to about 20 different cities. And it ultimately came down between Denver and here. At first, here was considered to be downtown Dallas proper. And at some point, somebody in the process said, have you checked out Arlington? And they came over to Arlington. In fact, it's such a cool story. We've put together a short documentary about six-minute episodes. We'll release that soon on the why Arlington. But to answer this question specifically, Arlington is smack dab in the middle of DFW. It's convenient for people to the west in Fort Worth or the east in Dallas or the north in Frisco, the Colony, or south in Mansfield or wherever. Everybody can kind of come to the middle. And it kind of bridges the gap culturally between all those different communities. Happens, the DFW Metroplex happens to also be in the middle of the state, and here we are also in the middle of the United States. Gigantic airport with a major airline hubbed here, so a lot of Americans are coming through DFW. If you've got an extended layover, you can pop work just 10 minutes away. I mean, there's so many benefits to being right here. The city of Arlington last year had 15.6 million visitors. As you correctly mentioned, a lot of that is sports related, but when those stadiums are out of the sports season, there's magnificent concerts and other things, rodeos and monster trucks, and all of that brings visitors to the area. And we hope that we can add something else to their experience besides that event that they're traveling to.
It's funny that you mentioned the airport, because I just got back from a trip, and there are those times when you've got like a 5-hour layover at an airport, and you just think, what am I gonna do at this time? Well, now you've got something really incredible to be able to go see and appreciate. Let's talk a little bit about the people who are honored here. The Medal of Honor is, you know, for there may be people who, you know, they've heard of this star or that award, and they sort of think of them and group them all as one. This one stands above all the rest. Can you explain what it is and why it is so special?
So the Medal of Honor is our nation's highest award for valor on the battlefield. And, if for those that aren't familiar with military awards, there's now a tiered layer, tiered system of awards. You know, if you want to recognize somebody for who does a good job at the end of their tour of duty just in the United States, you get, well, some level award, an Army commendation, Navy commendation, and there's varying levels of, with some comes with more seniority and more bravery. The apex of that system is the Medal of Honor. And in the Civil War, when the award was first brought into existence, 1861, it was the only medal at all in the military. You either got the Medal of Honor or you had no medal at all. And therefore, the predominance of the 3,528 awards of the medal are Civil War time frame. Nowadays, it's a very, very, very rare medal to be awarded. The action needs to happen in a combat situation. The action needs to be observed by at least two people. The recipients joke around and say, one of those people needs to know how to write. They have to put something on paper and submit it through the chain of command for the Army awards, for the military awards process to happen. In a fast case anymore, it could be a couple years from action to award, and sometimes the recognition is delayed for various reasons for decades to come. So it's quite a special situation. For example, I served as a Navy guy for 28 years of my life, and in that time, I knew about the Medal of Honor, but I never met a real human being Medal of Honor recipient until I took this job.
Really?
4 years ago.
Huh, that's surprising. And you were no slouch in your service either. Not only did you serve as an astronaut with NASA, but also, as you mentioned, as a U.S. Navy SEAL, you've had Bronze Stars, including with Valor. And even you had never met a Medal of Honor recipient until you took on this job.
Right. Ironically, very ironically, Britt Slabinski, one of the living Medal of Honor recipients, is another Navy SEAL. On the day of his action, March 3rd and 4th in 2002, I was also in Afghanistan with our SEAL platoon, and we were what's called a quick reaction force, and I was one ridge line away, about a mile away from his action, and there'd been three helicopters had already been lost in the course of that, and we were ready to fly and go render aid and see if we could help, but the decision at higher headquarters was we can't risk another helicopter in broad daylight. So I listened to Britt's action on the radio for about 12 hours until night fell, and by then it was over, but that's one that's very, very close to home for me, and he's a personal friend.
Was that clear to you, though, when you were listening to all of that on the radio, and then later he is a Medal of Honor recipient? Was it clear to you in real time there that, oh my God, this is extraordinary, this is above and beyond?
Well, it was very clear that the situation was extraordinary and dire, and they were outmanned, outgunned, out tactically advantaged. And there was so much chaos on the radio. Imagine you're talking on your cell phone and 20 people are all talking at the same time. It was very, very difficult to understand sentences. It was difficult to understand who's asking for what. What's a clear picture? So you couldn't really hear specific voices, but you just could tell from that cacophony of noise that this was unlike anything else that I had ever heard of. And I didn't, in the moment, I didn't think, oh, there's a Medal of Honor action out of that story. You just knew that those gentlemen were in dire straits, and we just hope the best for them because we are helpless.
And throughout these many years that this award has been given, there have been similar situations like that over and over in different conflicts where someone went far above and beyond the call of duty. I'm curious, when you're putting something together like this, and obviously you're overseeing this entire place now, you've read so many of the stories, you've seen so many of the stories, you're intimately familiar with them. Do they stay with you? Do they blow you away? You've heard things, you've seen things out in actual situations, but when you read these stories and internalize them, what is it like for you?
Well, for me, now that I'm in the role and I have met many of the 61 living, the light bulb has really come on that they are normal human beings. They're a person that gets up in the morning, puts their pants on, brushes their teeth, and sets out to see what today's going to bring. And in some regards, they're no different than you and I. And that's what I think is important for the visitor to the museum to realize, well, shoot, we all have endless access to the same bucket of courage, and you pull stuff out of it and it keeps getting filled. It's just your choice if you want to dig into that bucket or not. So one of the unsuspected things that I cherish about this job is not the title or paycheck or nothing. It's the 15 minutes in a gate waiting for an airport sitting next to one of them. It's standing next to one of them yesterday looking at their own exhibit, just he and I. It's having one of the spouses two nights ago come up to me. I was just sitting there eating some food, and she said, I want to say thank you to you and your staff for what you have delivered to my husband and all of these gentlemen. So it's those little tiny moments that are seemingly insignificant in the big picture, but those are the things that are going to stay with me for the rest of my life.
A couple of threads in there I'd like to pull on. You mentioned that we only have 61 of these heroes still with us right now. And I believe that for the opening weekend, you all had more than half of them here to actually see the museum and the opening and so forth. But you had these private moments where they were able to see their exhibit and I assume other exhibits around the museum. How do they handle it? These are, I would imagine, are very private people who don't want the attention. They say, you know, I was just doing mm-hmm. my job. I'm not a hero. But the rest of us, of course, see them as such. Do they sort of fit that mold?
Oh, they certainly do. And everyone, they're just people with different personalities, just like we are. So some need the more reflective, quiet time. I'm going to soak this in on my own. Others are more comfortable telling their family members. And for example, Pat Brady, Medal of Honor recipient, Vietnam helicopter pilot. Mm-hmm. The helicopter that we have up in the exhibit hall is his helicopter. You could see him beaming with pride as he had his kids and his grandkids and his great-grandkids up there standing next to him, showing the helicopter that he flew. It has his wife's name on the side of the helicopter. And that made me feel really, it was pretty special to see the pride coming out of him to pass it on to the next generation of Bradys in mm-hmm. this case. Yeah.
And there's nothing like seeing it right in front of you like that in such a grand way. You mentioned that, you know, these are all just regular people like you and me in some regards, but those stories do have to be just awe-inspiring to you when you see what people faced and what they did. And you're so familiar with the stories that are presented in this museum. Does it still boggle your mind when you see some of these details of some of these stories?
Yeah, it really does. There's one I was just telling another group about that I recently kind of became more familiar with the story. It's a gentleman named Tibor Rubin. He was a young person in a Nazi concentration camp and survived to the end and was so inspired by the GIs that liberated his camp that when he became old enough, he became a member of the U.S. Army, found himself in Korea and fighting there, and then became a prisoner of war in a Chinese concentration camp. And through the resilience that he learned as a young person in a European concentration camp, he inspired, and his positive attitude encouraged his Korean fellow prisoners to get through that, and he was later awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions and courageous behavior. And it's like, how in the world does in one person's life they are two times interned? Like, I just can't even comprehend that one. And that's just one example, and there's, as you correctly said, there's a million. Every one of them hits you in a different way.
It sounds like one of those places where you could spend hours and just get lost in this.
Yeah. Truly. That's why I think, and this is not a sales pitch, but I think it's a smart way to do it if you're locally, is to get a membership so you can come any day you want. If you just got 2 hours or an hour or even just a lunch break, you can come in, go to one thing and take it all in a very deep way, and then get out and come back another time. You know, if you're out of town and you're traveling here, certainly that's not an option, and you still can become a member, but you might have to do it all at once.
Yeah, because, you know, and we can't underscore this enough, these are such extraordinary acts of heroism that any one of these, or all of these, could be, you know, to put it in layman's terms, a movie or a documentary of its own.
That's funny you should say that. I had a little bit of introductory words to the formal dinner a couple nights ago, and I said exactly that. You know, each of these stories are unique. Each of these could be its own feature film. Each of these could be its own novel. Each of these could be its own museum by itself. But yet the common thread of all that is they're people who grew up in small towns, big towns, California, Maine, you know, all over the country, different services, played soccer, played football, played basketball, was in the band. We have an FFA jacket up there from Clinton Rome. So it's a cross-section of the United States.
I think a lot of people might hear about this place and think of it as a quote-unquote military museum that might really, you know, let's take young Johnny or young Jackie and expose them to this, and maybe they will want to, you know, go into a life of service in the military. You were talking about this a moment ago. This isn't just to, you know, perhaps inspire the next generation of military heroes. This could inspire the next generation of heroes, period. And it doesn't have to be a kid. It can be an adult. It can be an older person. It can be anybody who walks away from this and says, those are extraordinary stories, but we can all do extraordinary things in our own lives.
That, quite simply, is our mission. Inspire people when they visit, inspire America. And what do we mean by that? It's a big lofty statement. We really mean you can put these values into action in your own life. You know, very few of the visitors that come here are going to be in a uniform, in a combat situation, overseas, with chaos happening around you, and have to make one of these types of decisions. But everybody needs a little bit of courage. Do I accept a new job? Do I move my family across the country? How do I get through this cancer battle? A tough conversation with your teenage son or daughter. You know, all those things take a different little bit of courage, and it's through these stories that we hope people we inspire people.
I promise we're almost done because I know you've got a million things to get to. One big benefit for Texas is that we have education that comes out of this center and is actually going into school curriculum, sort of, you know, bringing that message home to kids that you can do extraordinary things.
You know, that's exactly right. It's one of the things I'm most excited about, because the future of our country is our youth right now, and we want leaders of character in the future. And how do you do that? You start with sprinkling in some motivating stories like this early on, where it can resonate with a kid. And right now we're focused on about middle school seventh and eighth graders. We piloted a program in Arlington ISD this past fall that was very successful. We have all the teacher handouts, we have all the student handouts ready. We send that to the schools. We've got 13 schools signed up, school districts signed up in the greater DFW area, but also in Austin School District for that program next fall. And then I anticipate the year after that, scaling it statewide and then soon to the nation, because we want to inspire America, but you can't do that with only people that can come to the building physically.
So well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Very glad to be here.
A fantastic place, and we really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
If you can physically make your way to the building, though, it is certainly worth it. Again, it's in Arlington. It's right there next to where the Cowboys and the Texas Rangers play, and it is absolutely exceptional. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I will tell you that the opening movie that you see, and I don't remember how long it was, maybe 5 or 10 minutes before you even start to explore the museum, is just an absolute one of a kind. It is immersive, and it will pull on every emotion. And so if you can, get there and check it out. This is a huge piece of our national history and some of the best of it too. If you would like to watch the interviews, if you just listened to them just now, check us out on WFAA Plus on your smart TV. It is an app that you can download. It is totally free. We'll see you next week.